Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now, I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Natalie Banner. Natalie, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are at the Wellcome Trust and lead on a big project called Understanding Patient Data, which we'll get to. I understand that you studied psychology back in the day and would love to understand what your focus is now.
Thanks very much, Chris. Yeah, so my background was I started off studying philosophy and psychology, and that was my sort of initial undergrad and went into study philosophy of psychiatry and mental disorder. And I was always really interested in the intersection between different disciplines. So I love to explore, you know, what philosophy could contribute to psychology and vice versa, and particularly in the field of mental health, which was a real passion of mine. And I went on to do a PhD in the philosophy of psychiatry, exploring conceptual questions around how we define mental disorder and what it means to have capacity to make decisions about things. So always really interested in kind of the intersections between different disciplines and trying to build bridges between them and get them to talk to one another. That was really where I found my kind of interest and passion. But much as I enjoyed thinking deep thoughts as a philosopher, I realized I wanted to do something that had a bit more of a clear-cut impact in the world and on people and on practice, sort of staying in the health space. But I really wanted to sort of make a bit more difference than, you know, publishing some papers that maybe three people might read, if I'm honest. So during my postdoc, I did a fellowship at POST, the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology in Westminster. And that kind of opened my eyes to the world of policy making, briefing, and decision making. And that fellowship I really, really enjoyed. It was 3 months sort of based in Parliament, and I absolutely loved it. And on the back of that, I got a job at Wellcome in their policy team. So that was just a really exciting shift for me, going from academia into the world of policy. Very steep learning curve, complete change of emphasis. But I kind of enjoyed the shift. And at Wellcome, I started off focusing on the ethics and governance of particularly genetic and genomic research. And that kind of started to get me into the data niche. And from there, I did a lot of work on data protection, particularly the General Data Protection Regulation as it came into UK law in 2018. And from there, started to do more work and thinking around kind of policy development on data. But drawing on the interest I had in kind of getting different disciplines and different sectors and different people to talk to one another and use a common language, that's definitely been a sort of strong thread. And, you know, building on that policy work in the Wellcome policy team, I then joined Understanding Patient Data when it was set up in 2016 and started leading the initiative from a couple of years ago, and now actually have a team around me, which is fantastic and really exciting to be part of that. And we're starting to focus more and more on data science, AI, the kind of big technology developments as well in data. And our focus really is on trying to make sure that the way that data and health data is used is a bit more visible and understandable for people, because it's very technical, it's quite jargony, it's quite confusing, there's a lot of controversy around it. And we want to just make sure that we sort of bring the voices of people and their questions and concerns to policymakers, to those who are making decisions about how to manage and use data, hopefully to sort of, you know, help advance healthcare and bring benefits back to everyone. So that's the kind of overall trajectory of how I've ended up where I am. Very much in a data niche that I didn't really anticipate when I set out, I have to be honest.
And am I right in saying that as part of that work, and this is a slightly flippant comment, you are the creator of the famous Data Saves Live badges?
We did create the badges. We're not responsible for the slogan, for the Data Saves Live slogan. That did pre-exist us, but we did create the badges. And oh my goodness, I had no idea how effective the take-up of an idea could be if you just have merch Honestly, yeah. Every conference and exhibition we went to, people love the badges. So that's been our most effective kind of outreach activity to date, I think.
Well, not that one ever wears jackets anymore, but on one of my jackets, I do have a Data Saves Life badge on my lapel. So there you go. It's reaching everywhere. There's a huge amount to unpack in your background. I wonder if we start with some of the policy questions on genetics and genomics that you were working on previously at the Wellcome. What were some of the questions there, and where did those questions come from? And do you feel like there are now clear answers to some of those questions?
Yeah, when I started working on these questions, there were a couple that I think were people were beginning to realize there were challenges, but hadn't really worked out what to do about them and how to address them. So one of the first big ones was the notion of anonymization, the idea that data could have all of the identifying information removed from it, and you could not possibly trace back the identity of the person that the data came from originally. And in a lot of genetic research, people were working with databases on the assumption that the data was fully anonymized. And as I joined Wellcome, I think that there had fairly recently been a paper that had shown that I think from the Thousand Genomes Project in the States, somebody had managed to piece together some identities of individuals based on publicly available information. They'd been looking at genealogy databases, so, you know, where people kind of get their ancestry data and they sign up and you can find out, you know, you've got a fifth cousin in Utah or something like that. And someone had done some research to explore in quite a lot of detail how you could piece together publicly available information and actually work out the identities of some people from data that we'd previously thought it was not possible to tell who anyone was. And this caused quite a stir because it meant that it might you might need to put in some further safeguards, that data might not be able to be as open as you'd originally want it to be. You know, ideally, you want as many people as possible to be able to work with the data to do research. But actually, suddenly, those questions of privacy became much, much more focused. And that was a real challenge because you had all these researchers who were very used to, you know, sharing this data and using it openly, suddenly go, suddenly we might be able to identify people from this. And I think at that time, no one quite knew how to handle those questions around privacy and the technical methods for potentially yielding identities and re-identifying people from data were kind of just becoming a little bit more prominent for the research community. So that was probably the biggest question that was emerging. I'd say the other one was to do with consent and how much people could possibly know about how their data might be used. You know, in the research world, we've often relied on the idea of informed consent, where you participate in a trial or a study, you sign up to it, and it's clear to you, this is what the data will be used for. This is how we will do this research. These are the questions we're wanting to answer. But with an increase in the availability of genetic and genomic data and new technology being developed all the time, it's much harder to be able to say, this is exactly how we will use your data, because there's all sorts of possibilities you didn't anticipate at the time of signing up to the study. So there's a really big challenge into how you can meaningfully consent someone when you don't necessarily know how that data might be used in future. There could be different people wanting to use it. There could be different research questions. It could be used internationally. You know, there's all sorts of challenges there in meaningfully enabling someone to consent to the use of that data. And I don't think we've yet quite cracked how to solve that, especially because technology and the use of data is kind of evolving so quickly.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because those two questions are, to some extent, quite closely interlinked. The consent or the how people feel about sharing their data will, to some extent, be determined by how much or how sensitive those data sets are. Did you develop at the time, or do you have a sense now of effectively a set of best practices around that? How what should researchers or people putting together these kind of data sets be thinking about?
Well, I think it's definitely still evolving because the technology is evolving and the range of data sets and data types that you might be able to draw in to answer research questions is developing hugely. So I'm not sure if there's a kind of established set of best practices, but a couple of key things I would say is one is don't ever assume that the data is anonymous and anonymized, that actually the standard for anonymizing data is incredibly high. And actually, it could be that in order to effectively anonymize data, you have to take so much information out of it that it's not very useful anymore. So kind of being open and honest about the fact that you will do everything you can to protect the data, you'll take steps to mitigate risk, but you never 100% guarantee that it's completely private and always will be, I think is a good first step. And that's something that I think the research community is kind of on a bit of a journey with, because we're quite used to this, you know, oh, if you anonymize the data, you know, then you can, there's all sorts of things that you can do with it. And I just think that that has to shift. So certainly the first one would be not pretending that everything is completely possible to anonymize, I'd say is the first one. And the second, I think, is around kind of understanding data governance better and being open and transparent about how decisions are made on what data gets used for, who gets access to it, what are they doing with it? Are the benefits that are being claimed actually coming to pass? And, you know, increasing that level of transparency and openness about data, which is challenging because I think a lot of researchers are, you know, kind of used to basically saying, look, we're doing good things. You don't need to know all the details. But actually, there's a real appetite among people for finding out about what's happening to data and, you know, where the benefits are coming from. So, you know, that increased transparency and openness, which I think brings with it a certain level of public accountability. Those are steps that I think are being made, you know, slowly but surely, that's kind of improving the way we're talking about data and kind of being open and honest with people about, you know, what's happening, what's not, how data's protected, what the risks are, and so on.
Absolutely. And I think there's a really interesting question about, particularly when it comes to genomic data or genetic data, inherent identifiability, right? That just like saying, right, we're going to take your fingerprints and we're going to put them on a piece of paper, but then we'll tear off the bit at the top that says your name. Now we've de-identified them and they're anonymous. It's like, well, they're still your fingerprints, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's still your genome. It's still unique to you, even if it's not linked to your address or your name or anything like that. And so I think, yeah, the point you make about then therefore explaining that to people and allowing them to make an informed, effectively sort of value decision, right? And I want to contribute to research because I'm motivated to do that, or I want to find a cure for myself or my kid or whatever it is. One of the things that's really struck me in the work that we do at Genomics England is how it's very, very difficult to talk about the public. What are public attitudes towards data, right? Because there's no such thing as a public opinion about this. One of the things that struck me early on was this really banal observation that sick people and well people think really differently about their data, especially people who are sick enough to be able to benefit from whole genome sequence diagnostics. They may well have a rare disease or cancer. And in their minds, the trade-off between me giving my data to research or for clinical use and the benefit that I or my kid or my family can get is very clear-cut. And often those people have become very expert in both the conditions that they have and how their data will be used, versus people who may not have a condition, who may not have thought about it deeply, and who might have an instinctive bias towards privacy or not sharing. That's a very, very crude segmentation of how different people think about this. In your work, have you either developed or thought about how we can start to try and map these different attitudes in a slightly more granular or kind of segmented way?
Yeah, it's a very good point that the public is not homogenous. And I think the first thing to note is actually a lot of the attitudes research that's been done, including ours, has taken quite a sort of generic view of the UK public. We've tried to get kind of representative views, but actually we've done very, very little to understand if there are differences depending on your background, depending on your particular experiences, if there's rural-urban splits, if there's age differences, if your ethnic heritage makes a difference to how you might feel about data use and so on. So I think, you know, there's certainly a need to do a much more kind of fine-grained understanding of what those different attitudes might be. It's a good point about the, you know, whether you're sick or well or can sort of perceive the immediate potential benefits to yourself or your family. I think what it comes down to is what matters to people, what it is that people care about. We did a piece of work last year called How to Talk About Data Without Talking About Data, which was essentially a piece of work we did with a design agency, Camusi, that tried to flip the data narrative on its head. So normally from the perspective of a data initiative or policymakers, you start with the data and you say, well, the data can do all this and using data can enable us to do X, Y, Z. As an average person on the street, I don't care about that. That's not something that makes a difference to my life. And you say the word data and I'm kind of asleep already, unless I see a scary headline that kind of freaks me out. So we tried to flip it on its head and say, well, in people's interactions with their healthcare, on their healthcare journey, if they're engaging with a clinician or their medication is changing or they get a new diagnosis or they're trying to manage their symptoms or a condition, what are the touch points in that journey where they might be interested in learning something about how their care is being informed by data? So let's say you're started on a new medication. Is there an opportunity there to, you know, inform people in a, just a little nugget of information about, well, we're doing this because we've done research in the past using data from other people that suggests this is the appropriate or the most, you know, likely to succeed medication for you. And actually, we can use information that we're getting as you're taking this medication to inform the care of other people in the future. And actually, we found that that really resonated with people, whether they were managing a long-term condition or people who didn't often, you know, use the health service. If you're starting from the perspective of what matters to people in their interactions in their healthcare, then you have a much greater chance of kind of conveying useful information to them. And actually, that does it does mean that you don't have this kind of clear segmentation between the sick and the well, because for everyone, your starting point is, what do you care about? What matters to you? How can we talk about data in a way that makes sense and kind of resonates with the things that you care about? So on the one hand, you sort of need to do this more fine-grained analysis of people's views and attitudes. But on the other, we're all people. There's all certain things that we care about and certain things that we don't. And if the narratives and the stories we tell about data can appeal to the things that matter, then I think we have a much better chance of really kind of engaging with people and understanding where their questions, concerns, or hopes and aspirations lie as well.
It's a really interesting story. And to some extent, there's an implied, not necessarily responsibility, but a placing that in a context for an individual. So you're saying, well, actually, you're benefiting, by the way, because previously a bunch of people have chosen to donate their data or their samples or their time or whatever in order to enable us to learn this thing about your condition, which is now benefiting you. I guess in a context of genetics and genomics, that's particularly true because we can only derive insights about one person's genome or the variations in there by having a big extant data set of what kind of quote unquote normal look. Do you think there are situations in which there is a responsibility or I don't know quite how to frame it, an obligation almost for people who are benefiting from particular data sets to also kind of pay it back or pay it forward or whatever, to contribute back into that knowledge base which is benefiting them?
Yeah, this kind of comes to the sort of social license, right, for the social contract, I guess, for using data. You know, if you're benefiting from research, then, you know, should you necessarily allow your data to be used and to participate in that way?
We're going back to your philosophy days here.
Well, exactly. It's fundamentally a values based question. Yeah. And I think the critical thing to note there is there's going to be no single answer to that. People will come at this with a variety of views and values, and those views and values are going to be informed by their past treatment, by the healthcare system, by the system more generally. They're going to be informed by personal views, by experiences of other people close to you. And actually, one of the challenges, I think, for creating a system of data management and use that is trustworthy is, how on earth do you accommodate that diversity of views and values? How can you create an environment in which you are, you know, responsive to and respectful of the fact there are going to be different views and opinions on what's okay and what's not and what the expectations are? And that is a real challenge. I think that to specifically respond to that question of kind of is it your duty or is it your responsibility or obligation, I think the worry with taking that approach is that you then end up potentially really disenfranchising quite a large group of people who may have good reason to feel nervous and skeptical. And you're saying, well, you know, we're doing great things with the data. Yes, but also you might have been disenfranchised, marginalized, discriminated against. So, you know, there are legitimate reasons for concern. And I think particularly with some of the behavior of, you know, some big tech companies and so on, people, you know, it's not as though every use of data has been entirely benign and benefited some people. There's so many examples of like inadvertently racist algorithms, for example. It's not like everything is going swimmingly in the world of trying to use data to develop new technologies and new interventions. So, you know, there are legitimate reasons to be concerned. And for that reason, I wouldn't say it's kind of a duty or an obligation on individuals, but I would say it's incumbent on those who are using data and who are trying to develop new treatments, new technologies, and so on, to be very clear and open about what they're trying to do, what their motivations are, and where those benefits are accruing, you know, to talk about them in a more open way. And actually also, to be honest, where it's not working out the way that we might have anticipated.
It's an interesting situation, isn't it? And I'd love to understand if your work has pointed to any kind of brass tacks ways for people to do this. You know, if I'm a researcher kicking off a research project, if I'm an entrepreneur trying to get a startup off the ground, we can sit here and have a conversation about we need to engage with patients, with public, and so on. What do I do? Like, I pick up the phone and dial public data and like someone. What are some good practical ways that people can actually ask these questions?
Well, we field a lot of those calls, I think. And actually, you know, our advice tends to be the same. It depends what you want. It depends what you're trying to do. I think if you're approaching questions around public engagement and involvement as how do I convince people that we're the good guys, then you basically what you need is a marketing campaign. If you are genuinely interested in ensuring that your business model or your approach to the research questions you're trying to ask is meaningfully informed by public views and values, then that means that you have to sort of put yourself in that position of jeopardy of if you do go and ask people and you do, you know, run a focus group or do a survey or, you know, do some deliberative engagement with a group of patients who have the condition that you're interested in, that you would actually respond to and change what you're doing as a result of what they say. If you're willing to do that, then I would say the doors would be wide open for finding, engaged people who would like to help you to achieve the things that you want to do. But I do think a lot of the time the approach is very much, how do we make people trust us? And I just think if that's the question you're asking, then A, we can't help you. And B, you know, I don't necessarily think you're doing things in a way that is conducive to trustworthiness. We often say, the focus on trustworthiness that we have, very much inspired by Honora O'Neill, our sort of guiding light in all of this, again, philosophy, hurrah, is if you focus on trustworthiness, you're focusing on the system and the decisions and the structures you're putting in place to manage and use data. If you say, oh, we want people to trust us, you're putting something on them to do. Like, what do they owe you? They don't really owe you anything, but you're kind of demanding something of other people without necessarily giving them good reason to have that trust and that confidence in you. So, you know, I appreciate it can be really challenging from a practical perspective to know what on earth to do. But I think it starts with the question, what is it we're trying to achieve? To what extent do we want our business model or our research to be informed by the people who ultimately are supposed to be the beneficiaries of this research, intervention, tool, technology? That could be health professionals. I think health professionals are often really neglected in all of this. We assume the public is, you know, the great British public or something. And actually health professionals are a huge, vault of expertise and often the ones who are the most skeptical about data use. So there's a huge range of different things you can do, but it starts with being clear on, you know, what's in it, what's the thing you're trying to achieve by engaging with patients, the public, health professionals.
You mentioned systems there and trust and so on. I'd love to understand if you've seen models emerging which you think are either interesting or kind of emerging best practices. So as an example, at Genomics England, we have a thing called the ARC, the Access Review Committee, which decides whether researchers or companies get access to the de-identified data in our research environment. Mm-hmm. And the participants who have donated their data through the process actually elect representatives who sit in the ARC and can veto access if they think it's unclear or if they don't like what a researcher or a company is proposing to do.
they can just say no. So that, to some extent, is not just asking their opinions, but giving them power. Mm-hmm. And for us to overturn their veto, it would actually have to go up to the Secretary of State, which would be quite a big deal and has never happened. Have you seen other models that, I guess, facilitate either that that engagement, that transparency, that empowerment, or other angles that can not just, as you say, fulfill this mission of please trust us, but can demonstrably earn that trust, so to speak?
Yeah, definitely. So there, I think there are different aspects of kind of trustworthiness that you can kind of you can focus on. We tend to think of it in terms of sort of three pillars. You've got the technical aspects, and that's to do with, you know, the data security. If you've got, you know, privacy enhancing technologies, it's the kind of back end, how you structure the management of data and so on. And that's that sort of more technical aspect is a really important aspect of trust and trustworthiness. I think, you know, with what you do with Genomics England is, you know, real case in point for that, as to how you actually just technically manage the security of the data and demonstrate you have the competence to use it correctly and mitigate against breaches. That's one thing. Second one is kind of the institutional aspects of trust and trustworthiness, which is more about the kind of policies and governance and processes. And I would say there's a couple of really nice examples of how you can kind of set up those institutional policies that can be quite sort of responsive to people. So the One London engagement dialogue that was done last year, I think, is a really nice example of this, where there was a very clear commitment that the way in which the shared healthcare record was going to be rolled out would respond to the input from the publics that the dialogue included. And that commitment was kind of made very clearly. They said, we are going to develop our policies and processes in light of what you are telling us. And that is inherently a kind of trust building exercise. Even if as a Londoner, I was not part of that process, knowing that there had been that input and that there had been that sort of attention paid to public and participants, you know, would help me feel inherently that process was more trustworthy.
And it sounds like a trivial thing, but I remember reflecting at the time, I was talking with Sarah Wilkinson, the chief exec of NHS Digital. And I said, oh, what are you doing this weekend? And she said, oh, I'm spending the whole weekend in a consultation with One London. And I was like, okay, that's a non-trivial sign that you're taking this seriously. You're giving up your whole weekend to this. And on the one level, it's completely flippant point. But if it's a 10-minute, you know, consultation via Zoom or something, that's one level of commitment. If it's giving up your entire weekend or probably multiple weekends, that's that demonstrates some level of commitment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the sort of openness of that commitment as well means that you can be held to account for it, right? So it's not just a thing that you've said that, you know, people can then ignore. It's like, no, we're going to come back to this. And I think they're going to have some future events as well that can really articulate how they've been responding to the findings from that work as well. The other aspect of trustworthiness, we think, is more to do with the kind of social, and I think the that's to do with communication, transparency, openness about what you're doing, what your motivations are, what you're trying to achieve. And the recovery trial has been really, really good in this, that Martin Landry has set up and his team for exploring COVID treatments, because they, you know, that uses routinely collected data. It's got really clearly defined aim and scope. To identify new treatments for people hospitalised with COVID. They've got really good, detailed, proactive communications about what they're trying to achieve, what data is used, why that's important. And I think you'd be hard-pushed to find anyone who looks at the recovery trial and thinks, well, they haven't done a good job there. You know, they've done a phenomenal job, not just because of the outputs of the trial, but because of the way they've set up the communications and trying to be very, very open from the outset about what they're trying to do and how they'll do it. So I think that's a really nice example of real clarity and transparency in how you talk about what is a very, very, you know, massive and complex trials process.
I'd love to come back. You mentioned earlier about the how to talk about data without talking about data piece. There's a nice quote, which at least is attributed to you. I'm hoping it's from you. Which says, data tables do not tell the story of a journey through cancer, an exhausting battle with pain, the uncertainty and ambiguity of the diagnostic odyssey, or the anxiety of a trauma. That really resonated with me in terms of how we can think about telling stories more powerfully here, rather than presenting dry policy documents or, you know, long legal documents or data tables. How do you think we can communicate better with each other, with patients, with research participants, with the public about these kind of issues in a way which is human and not cold or bureaucratic?
Yeah, the stories I think are absolutely critical. And I think because data is quite a technical topic, it is quite jargony, it's difficult to sort of get your head around. And unless you are sort of technically minded, you know, certainly in work that we did a couple of years ago, I have a quote. I use it as a slide sometimes, and it's a quote from a workshop participant who just said, "Oh, you say the word data and I fall asleep." You know, it's not necessarily starting off from being an incredibly engaging topic for people. But I think that the stories point comes back to what I said before about what matters to people, but also about the benefits. And we say, oh, you need to be clear on the benefits of using data, as though that is a straightforward thing to do. It's really not. And actually, when you look at a lot of the studies that come out using health data, using genetic data, you know, they sort of presume that you understand what the benefit is if there has been a research paper that's been published, or there has been a change in some like NICE guidance or something like that off the back of this research. To the average person, indeed to me, I can't see that as being a benefit necessarily. That to me doesn't translate into life saved, quality of life improved, you know, something that has an impact on people, right? So we're not telling those stories that connect all the way from data of this sort collected in this way, used for this purpose, this research done, this analysis, this interpretation, this output that then led to this benefit. And this benefit cannot just be research paper X appearing in the Lancet, because that's not something that resonates with people. If you can take that and then say, and as a result of that, we changed practice in this way and we've saved this many lives, or you know, this has been the impact on patients, and you have a story about a patient whose care has been, you know, transformed by this particular insight, then you have a story. But our stories don't have that beginning, middle and end. They are technical, and they are very focused just on the datary bit in the middle and not the stuff that actually matters to people.
And you made a great point earlier about honesty and transparency around the benefits to the researchers and the research institutions themselves. I remember a great conversation with a researcher and a couple of our participant panel at Genomics England, and the researcher was explaining the research that they were doing, and the participant said, "And what will the benefits be for you?" Mm-hmm. And the researcher said, "Oh, no, but it's all about benefits for you. It's about us finding new cures. And, you know, if this goes well, we could identify biomarkers that could lead to new therapeutics and drugs." And they said, "Yeah, but hold on. But if this also goes well, this is good for you, right? You get a great paper which gets cited and you get ahead in your career and so on." The researcher looked really, really uncomfortable. Well, you know, I guess so, right? But they were like, "Well, that's cool. Yeah. You know, we're cool with that.
Yeah.
You know, it's good. You're doing something for us. You're trying to do this research to help find a drug that could help cure my kid. That's great. If you do well, I hope you get a promotion. That's fine. But like, let's be honest about it." And I thought it was just such a great conversation, because that's what people want, is just to be straightforward about it. Right. Don't kid me that this is a pure Mother Teresa kind of.
Yeah, no, I completely get that. And I think that applies. I think people often think that it just applies to kind of industry and business and sort of what's the business model. But I think you're right. It applies just as much to researchers. Of course, there is a motivation there. And, you know, you could be the world's most, you know, altruistic researcher, but of course there is a motivation there for you in terms of your academic progress and being able to get grants and your future career. Of course there is. And it's okay to be honest about that. People do feel very nervous about that, yeah, as though if it's anything other than pure altruism, you know, it will be seen negatively. But actually, as you say, people respond far better to a dose of, you know, realism and honesty, yeah, than they do kind of, they feel like you're not treating them with respect if you don't have that level of honesty about what's in it for you, whether you're a business or a researcher, academic researcher.
Adult to adult conversation.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. It's more sophisticated and nuanced than just "don't worry about it, we're looking after the data and good things will happen."
Yeah, they're there.
Yeah, exactly.
And you just use the magic words business model. There's this very thorny issue around commercial access to the identified patient data. There's an argument that says if we're giving companies access to data that's been generated, that's been publicly funded and freely donated by the patients and participants themselves, that's, you know, quote unquote, selling the NHS or ripping off patients and so on. There's an argument that says, actually, if we don't charge companies for this, then we're taking this free public good and we're giving it to a private company to then develop drugs that they can then sell back to the NHS for tons of money. And actually, we should be generating a return. What's the answer?
Well, I can give it. It's very simple. No, it's really not. So in a nutshell, we did some research last year that we published called The Foundations of Fairness, which explored public views on precisely that question of third party access to NHS health data. And third parties covered businesses of all sorts, charities, academic researchers. So, you know, wide spectrum of third party use. And we explored these questions with citizens' juries, and we did a survey as well. And we put to them a range of different business models, from sort of, you know, charging fees to royalty models to, you know, different kinds of licensing to IP sharing. I think there were about 9 different models that came from a paper that Imperial did. We basically put these to these citizens and these juries. And the advantage of a citizens' jury is it's a long deliberative process. These took sort of 2.5 days. So people got really stuck into the detail. They learned a lot about how these kinds of collaborations and partnerships can work. And what we came to at the end of it was the details of the specific business model and partnership arrangement were not the thing that people got kind of exercised about, or there wasn't a clear-cut preference for, okay, this is okay, but this isn't. The thing that they wanted to know was that the public benefit back to patients and the health system was the thing that was prioritized. And yes, there might be some profit being made, but that kind of has to be secondary to this benefit coming back to the health system and to patients first and foremost. And secondly, that it's fine if there's profit being made, but that openness and transparency was really critical, that there has to be a kind of a level of honesty, as we just talked about what that benefit is for each party. And ideally, for there to be a level of accountability there and a level of kind of public involvement in setting those rules of the game, that the interests of patients and the public could be represented in the decision-making processes. So it's not just, you know, something going on behind the scenes, a kind of backdoor deal that giving access to your mates for financial reward and so on, that there was a sort of level of openness and transparency about the fact that these deals were being done and the benefits were being articulated. Because actually, there's a huge amount of innovation that can be done when you're partnering with industry, when you're partnering with the private sector, in a way that the NHS just can't do itself. There's no way it can. And actually, there's really good advantages in some circumstances of working with the private sector. We need to talk about that and be more open about that. So there was a willingness to sort of back and endorse the idea of these sorts of partnerships, but on the condition of benefit being prioritised, a level of openness and transparency, and there being a degree of kind of someone representing public views and interests in that decision-making process. The model itself, the specifics of, you know, the financial transactions and so on, was not something that people got particularly hung up on. It was the higher level principles that mattered to them.
Got it. Yeah, someone once suggested to me that we needed a book, kind of like the 70s book, Where Do Babies Come From, called Where Do Drugs Come From? I worry that ends up being a sort of patronizing approach to take, but I think it's a good point about just being clear about why do we need to do this? And, you know, if we want to develop new therapeutics for condition X, you know, what does that actually entail? We've mentioned the C word a couple of times in passing, COVID, and the COPE regulations, the sort of emergency regulations for access to data that were passed by Parliament as part of that, have, along with an extremely urgent need, led to some fantastic rapid advances. We've talked about the recovery trials, we've talked about vaccine development and so on. What's your sense of what, if anything, will change long term on the back of this extraordinary accelerated collaboration and in many ways accelerated progress that's happened over the last 12 months or so?
As you say, it has changed things very dramatically and very quickly. On the one hand, COVID has really shown up the benefits of being able to use data quickly and effectively to join it up across multiple sources. and suddenly it's tangible, right? People are talking about the R number. No one would have talked about that 12 months ago. So it's suddenly much more tangible and much more present in people's minds, which means I think we have an opportunity and it's easier to talk about data and the benefits of it because there's a case that is crystal clear to everyone in a way that it never has been before. So it is much more tangible. I think the risks are therefore also more amplified as well. So there's been, you know, for all the good things that have happened, there's also been concern about third-party use and particularly the involvement of the private sector in some of the response to COVID and how quickly those things were set up in a way that was not necessarily as transparent as it could have been, with kind of the level of sort of oversight and scrutiny of kind of procurement processes and so on. So there's certainly lessons to learn. And I think that because we were in a sort of crisis situation, it doesn't mean that the sort of principles of good governance and so on need to go entirely out of the window. I think as we're shifting now towards thinking a little bit more long term, I fully expect some of the infrastructure and some of the policies and processes that have been set up may well stay with us because the benefits have been really clear. Actually, for some of them, and I think for COPI in particular, the real shift it made was kind of attitudes and perceptions among health professionals and those who were responsible for decisions about data. So it gave license to do things that they probably could have been doing anyway, but it just gave everyone a sense that, okay, it is all right to be doing this. It is all right to be allowing this data to be used and to be shared. And we can see the benefits that have come from that. So longer term, I think that some of the data sharing that has happened may well continue, especially when it comes to linking up data. So, for example, across health and social care, that's, you know, certainly highlighted a big gap there and a big need to do much, much more in the social care space. But I would like to see, and I think there's a risk if we don't see, a higher degree of transparency and engagement and involvement and consultation about what the rules should be in the longer term. I think the risk is if we don't do that, then you run the risk that once the sort of emergency phase of the pandemic is over and we've got a whole new bunch of kind of rules that are in place about how widely data can be shared and with whom and under what circumstances, you may well get a backlash. And I just think that's not something that needs to happen. It's going to be perfectly possible to set these things up in the right way for the long term if you take some time to do some engagement work, explore and find out exactly, you know, what data is being is useful and how what the sort of governance and structures and infrastructures need to be around that. So I hope that that's sort of the direction of travel. And certainly for a lot of the work we've done, you know, we've got good examples of how to do this well, and actually really nice examples of good practice. So I'm hoping that those can be embedded and we don't shoot ourselves in the foot by sort of rushing to put things in place without the proper guardrails, I guess.
Absolutely. And if we get this right, maybe final question, and in a spirit of storytelling, tell me a story about 5 years from now. We've got it right. We've threaded the needle. We've managed to do the engagement and the legislation and so on in the right way. Where could we be in 5 years from now?
I think in 5 years from now, if all of these things fall into place in the right way, I say fall into place, it will take active effort. If all of these things are, you know, attended to and there's really good efforts to put the right building blocks in place. The thing I'm most excited about in terms of the story would be, let's say I'm a patient that's just had a diagnosis of a condition and I can see all my notes and I know exactly what stage my test is at and I can get access to that information when I need to. And I go and see my specialist and they have everything there to hand. And they are supported by, you know, a decision-making tool, possibly a machine learning tool or something like that, to explore my options with me. And I understand and I have sufficient kind of awareness and information provided to me about how these kind of options are being presented. And we make a decision together and that is all logged in my record. And I can see exactly what information is being passed to different specialists at different points, and I feel more in control of what's happening in my healthcare. I think that for me would be the ultimate sign of a win in this space. Is even if you've got, you know, we can have these fantastic infrastructures and, you know, a great R&D industry and loads of research and investment, but ultimately if it doesn't come back to help the person who's having a really traumatic experience because they're frustrated and they don't know what the hell's going on, their data could be really helpful in enabling them to feel more in control, to understand what's happening, and to be more of a partner in their care. If we can get to that, then I think we've won and we've got a good benefit. So that to me would be the best outcome, I guess. Maybe 5 years is ambitious, but I don't think it needs to be. I think we can probably get to that point in the next 5 to 6 years.
It's fascinating. I love the picture that you paint, and two things strike me about it. One is that it feels like quite a long way from where we are now. Mm-hmm. But the second is that all of those technologies exist today.
They exist, right?
So yeah. It's not an innovation challenge. It's not a technology challenge. It's an engagement and a rollout and a training and a kind of from common sense to common practice type challenge, isn't it? Yeah,
definitely. And I think that sometimes we can sort of get hung up on the technicalities of things. For example, people saying, well, how many patients have access to their records? And the point isn't access, it's usability, it's usefulness. It's, is this actually something I can use as part of my care? I mean, I can get access to my GP records, but they're not very helpful because it doesn't have an awful lot of information in there. And I certainly couldn't use it as the basis for a conversation. So thinking more about the human, the culture, the social aspects of how we use data, I think is going to give us far more of a positive outlook than if we just focus on the kind of technical, can we tick that box aspect. As you say, the technology is largely there, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a that's an inspiring vision to leave us with, and marching orders all around to bring that vision into reality. Thanks so much for spending time with us today. And if people want to learn more about your work and understanding patient data, where should they look?
They can look either on Twitter, patient_data, or our website, understandingpatientdata.org.uk.
Amazing. Natalie, thanks so much for taking the time. And look forward to seeing the further outputs of your work.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series, and appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.